This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And me, Robert Peston. Steph, what have you been up to?
I have one of the most embarrassing stories to tell you, right, about what
actually,
happened.
If it's embarrassing by your standards, it's embarrassing.
Yeah, exactly. I took my daughter swimming, right, on Friday, and I had this bather on, and I was getting to get in the pool, and basically the bather popped open, flashing my boobs at what seemed to be just all men who were around the pool at this point. And I thought, well, you know, I was laughing about it. And then I took a photo, right, to send to my partner. But
you
I did
posted it on Instagram by mistake.
No. I sent it to my dad. Like, how horrendous is that? I sent my dad, like, an explicit picture. Anyway, it gets worse because I then managed to fix
the
bathing. Is he
at a hospital now, then?
No. Do you know what? It's never been brought up. So I'm like, it's right, been a few days now. It's mortifying. And I tried to do that unsend thing, you know, where you can unsend a picture. But my dad probably hasn't updated his phone, and it says, if this is not the latest version, it won't unsend on that phone. So I've been living in this like whole drama for the last few days of wondering whether my dad has seen this picture. And anyway, it gets worse because then I got into the pool and I'd fixed my bather, but then the whole thing totally collapsed and literally the zip flew off. I was holding my four-year-old. I had to shout the lifeguard person to come and find me some safety pins, and then I had to try and safety pin it up. I looked like a fat Elizabeth Hurley, you know, like that outfit she had where she had all the safety pins.
Oh, the safety pin one, the four weddings in a funeral publicity dress.
Yes,
oh,
exactly. Anyway, but so that was my hilariously humiliating weekend. But you've had a good one because you've been at the football last night, weren't you?
Well, it was very stressful because I had the combination of having to talk about the Prime Minister's inability for many, many, many hours to recognise racism.
Yeah, this is bad, isn't it?
On the news. So I had to go and do that. But I was also, before doing the news, I was at the Arsenal, but I missed extra time because I had to go and do my normal thing of putting into context the seeming difficulty that Downing Street has in stating the obvious.
So did you miss the penalties?
I missed the penalties. I mean, I saw them on my screen. I mean, I came off, literally walked off the set, you know, turned on the screen, and it was exciting.
Yeah, it was. Well, well done. Right, we're going to pick up a few things from the budget, aren't we? Yeah, so we're going to explain, aren't we, what national wealth funds are, what this idea is that Rachel Reeves and the gang she's put together have got in terms of what this might mean for the country. And then after the break, we're going to talk about the TV and film industry, because that was mentioned by the Chancellor in the budget. There's been a lot going on in the sector. There's some research that's come out saying that the sector's in crisis at the moment. So we're going to talk about what's happening there.
Not exactly from the budget, but we talked last week about how the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, had nicked a couple of Rachel Reeves' ideas, you know, the non-dom tax, the extension of the windfall levy on oil and gas. She confirmed, however, one aspect of what she would say is an important policy that they haven't nicked yet, which is the creation of something called a national wealth fund. And she mentioned that a number of, you know, pretty distinguished people from the world of sort of business and finance and regulation were going on the ball. So Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England, is going to be chairman of this National Wealth Fund. And then there's a couple of rather impressive business people. The chief executive of Barclays is going to go on the board, and the chief executive of Aviva, two huge financial institutions. I mean, we should point out, it was one of those slightly amazing moments that actually Carney, you think of both current and previous central bank governors as trying to remain, you know, politically neutral. In fact, there was this sort of slight intake of breath at the Labour Party conference when he came on the screen and basically endorsed Rachel Reeves as the next chancellor. And so, you know, he's got a bit of history of being nice to Rachel Reeves. But nonetheless, you know, he is a big hitter in the world of finance and a respected figure. And I think the other thing that's relevant about him in this context is he has been campaigning for years, even as Bank of England governor, to essentially compel financial institutions, especially banks, to take the risks of climate change seriously when they lend and invest. And the point about this National Wealth Fund, and you might want to talk a little bit about what it does, is that it's got this green focus. All its investments are either in helping to develop new power technologies or helping manufacturing, for example, to manufacture in a more green way. So it has got that focus.
Yes. And just for anyone who doesn't know what a national wealth fund is, it's, you know, it's, we call them sovereign wealth funds as well, but it's basically state-owned money invested into business in return for a stake in it. So it's a pretty simple concept. There's loads of them around the world. You know, the Middle East are obviously famous for it, with Saudi Arabia owning quite a few things here. But the thing that shocks me is that the biggest is Norway. Norway's Government Pension Fund Global, as they call it, which is the world's largest in terms of its asset value. And it's something like $1.6 trillion of assets that this fund has got.
It's a mind-boggling. That's just a mind-boggling sum of money to invest, and has been utterly transformative for the Norwegian economy. I was talking to some Swedish friends about this who are so resentful because, you know, Norway within recent history was the poor relation of Sweden. In fact, it was controlled by Sweden until 1906 from memory when Sweden gave Norway back to the Norwegians. And, you know, quite a lot of my friends, it's only half a joke, sort of talk about how they wish they hadn't allowed Norwegian independence because Norway is now so much richer. Yeah. And one of the things they talk about, I don't know, I thought this was hilarious, was apparently, because they've got so much money, the Norwegians have a quality of roads unlike any on the planet. So my friend was explaining that, you know, in this country, when you're sort of tarmacking a road, you dig down, I don't know, a few centimetres. There, they dig down meters and meters and lay the most astonishing amount
of potholes.
You know, they have the most expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, forget about potholes. It's, you know, it's like a roller skating rink every road in Sweden.
Well,
so they've got road envy in Sweden.
I go out to Norway now and again because my uncle Jim lives there. And he's a guy who worked in the shipbuilding industry in the Northeast and then ended up being, you know, offered a job in the oil industry in Norway. And we refer to him as Rich Uncle Jim because he's like got this amazing quality of life out there. And, you know, it does feel like it's a lot more functioning than we are here. He moans about tax quite a bit and other bits and bobs, but they definitely seem to be having a nice life out there.
This is also a really big point of distinction between the Reeves plan and pretty much every other sovereign wealth fund in the world, right? Norway accumulated these assets because of its enormous reserves of oil and gas, right? And they channeled a big chunk of the revenue from that into developing this store of value for generations to come. And that's what happened in the Middle East. So I remember in the 80s, when I was first a cub reporter in business, the most feared investment fund in the world was called the Kuwait Investment Office, right? And actually, the Kuwait Sovereign Wealth Fund is still massive, right? In fact, it's had a very, very good year. I don't think it's quite worth a trillion. It's probably about 700, 800 billion. But that, you know, most of us, we quite like 700 to 800 million down the back of the sofa. And, you know, I remember one of the biggest stories in the 1980s was around whether Kuwait would buy BP, which at the time was probably the most important British company. And there was it was almost a sort of national scandal about would Margaret Thatcher stop this, you know, Middle Eastern giant from buying this prize British company. In the end, they took a stake. They actually helped BP out of a hole when it needed to raise some money from memory, but they didn't end up owning the thing. But it just shows you, even back then, how powerful it was. And, you know, you'll probably remember this too. Again, particularly in Scotland, one of the so-called scandals of the 1980s, when we had this North Sea oil bonanza. And remember, we were a really powerful, not anymore, we were a really powerful oil nation. So it might feel to many people lost in the mists of time, but, you know, Britain was an oil and gas economy for many years. And, you know, the boom in the North Sea was transformative for the UK in terms of revenues, tax revenues coming in. And right from the start, and I'm really now going back to the 1980s, there were many serious people saying we should emulate what was going on, for example, in the Middle East and put some of this money away for a rainy day, create our own sovereign wealth fund. Instead, the government at the time, this was Margaret Thatcher, simply decided that the revenues that she was taking from the oil and gas companies in the form of petroleum revenue tax would simply be used on day-to-day spending. And that, look, let's be clear, that was useful money for the government, but it was all about meeting today's needs and not investing for the time when the oil and gas would run out. And obviously, over time, the, you know, our reserves have depleted. Controversially, of course, you know, there is now a consensus around the world that we should not be opening up more oil and gas fields. We have a government that says it is going to give more licenses to oil and gas. But even if those fields are ultimately developed, and there's still a bit of uncertainty around it, they're not massive. Okay, they're not going to generate vast amounts of revenue for the UK.
So the UK didn't take part in what Norway did, but Shetland did, didn't they? So Shetland were the only part of the UK who did do a deal with the oil companies to essentially be paid like a disturbance payment, which they then, you know, pumped into other things. They invested in other things. So they, you know, they've built up incredible assets from that. But they also have put quite a lot of that money through their charitable trust into making Shetland better. So they, you know, spent a lot of money on museums, art centres. I'm told their old people's homes are really good off the back of this money. So they did use this money, invest in other things, and put it into making the, you know, the islands a better place. And talking to my friend who spends a lot of time there, she was saying it really did change the place for a generation.
And actually, I should point out that that money was responsible for one of my all-time great television moments. I made a film about Scotland's desire to be independent. I spent a bit of time on Shetland, and they filmed me in a rather wonderful swimming pool that they built with all this money. And it became, you know, I was doing my piece to camera in the swimming pool.
What were you wearing?
Well, I wasn't flashing my boobs in a way that generated, you know, the kind of obviously interest that you recently have. But no, I swim in my glasses, right? And this became something of a talking point nationally.
Just about your glasses, though.
Just my glasses. Anyway.
And what was your point you were making in the pool?
I mean, just, I think, you know, what wonderful facilities Shetland had as a result of all the oil and gas well.
But the problem is that money's starting to run out a bit now there. And actually, you know, they haven't been able to do as good a deal in terms of the renewable energy that's happening out there, this new big wind farm. And so my friend was saying to me, the islands are kind of having to come to terms with the fact that they might not be the rich ones anymore. So it is interesting, I guess, as well, if you're reliant on, you know, they've been heavily reliant on the oil sector, how things can change, you know, as business changes in different sectors.
But I think that is, in a way, why you have to slightly admire, well, you certainly have to admire what Norway's done, because, well, they don't raid the assets to fund day-to-day spending. This is, you know, they reinvest all the time, all the way across the world. And it really is about making sure that the Norwegian economy is strong for the long term and for future generations. So they're not simply taking that money and spending it on today's needs. They're taking a long-term view. And that is what Saudi, for example, has been doing, a non-democratic example. In fact, pretty much all the you know, whether you're talking about, you know, Qatar or Kuwait, none of these countries are you know, democracies. They are, in effect, you know, you can call
dictatorships.
You might argue to an extent they're benign, but yes, they are dictatorships, although they've obviously got some very toxic ethical values, some would say, particularly in terms of the treatment of women and, you know, in some cases, ethnic minorities, and in some cases, obviously, LGBTQ+. These are not happy societies for, you know, lots and lots of people, but they are using these enormous amounts of money to try and diversify their economies. So, you know, they are making, in some cases, big investments in renewables. In some cases, we talked about Abu Dhabi's massive investment in artificial intelligence. So they are trying to use what they know is going to be the profits from oil and gas that will run out at some point to at least develop other industries which would sustain a decent living standard.
It's really interesting that the Saudi sovereign wealth funds and how they've pumped money into things here, because obviously the big one being, you know, pretty much owning Newcastle United. They've got an 80% stake in that. But, and, you know, talking to the university chancellor and things, they have started to see genuine economic benefit from it in terms of more foreign students going there.
So just to be clear, you're talking about people from the Middle East or from Saudi going
to Newcastle? Yeah, both, and just more generally, because it's put Newcastle United on a bigger platform. So they were saying, actually, they're already starting to see that impact. And also, for me as a Teesider, one of the big chemical companies there is SABIC, which is obviously Saudi owned. And they've invested, I think it was £1 billion 2 or 3 years ago in a big plant there. And then another billion the year after for a green recycling facility. I am seeing the impact in the Northeast in terms of money that's coming from the Saudis, which also is uncomfortable from I am a gay woman. So I wouldn't last long in Saudi.
No, but that is the point I'm making, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting to see that. Should we just talk as well about what Labour are saying they want to do, what they want this National Wealth Fund to be? Because they're talking, aren't they, about £7.3 billion being invested.
And just to be clear, we should point out, for starters, this is not a windfall, this £7.3 billion, you know, from some existing British stream of earnings. This is money they're going to borrow to shove in the wealth fund to then start investing. So this is not a surplus from somewhere else. This is very different from the Norwegian model where they just had all this money coming in from oil and gas. Therefore, the success, and this is a really important point, of their National Wealth Fund will depend on whether they then invest the money they've borrowed well. If they invest it badly, that 7.3 billion could turn into nil, right? If they invest it well and they get a decent return, then it could grow really quite substantially. And I suppose, therefore, I'd be interested to know what you think about this. I mean, what they're saying is, we will put this money into projects which need risk capital, right? They're basically saying they want the private sector to invest alongside them, but they'll put this money into projects where it's so-called additional, where the project probably wouldn't happen if this National Wealth Fund wasn't taking more risk than the private sector and sort of, in a sense, kick-starting it. Now, there are two things to say about that. If they choose well, then this will definitely be good for the UK and good for jobs. There is, of course, a danger that they'll lose this money.
And get slated for it as well.
Which is, you know, let's hope they don't worry too much about that, because all investors, you do end up losing money in order to have some investments where you make a lot of money. And I think, you know, we shouldn't slate governments who are taking risks if they're doing it in a sensible, managed, commercial way. But I suppose this is the interesting thing I'd like to ask you. Do you think it's better to invest rather than do the conventional thing, which is what governments traditionally do in this country, of just giving grants, subsidies?
Well, see, this, I think that they should get a stake in things. So, for example, I remember when, I think it was Rachel Reeves said this in the Labour Party conference last year, she cited SwiftKey as an example. So do you remember, this is that business that developed a kind of predictive keyboard for phones and tablets. It was started by two Cambridge graduates. They got £65,000 in two grants from the government through Innovate UK. And this allowed them to develop prototypes, to develop the app and actually set their business going. They then sold the business, I think it was 8 years later, to Microsoft for $250 million. So the point being, if we as the government had a share in that, even a tiny stake in it, there would have been a massive return compared to, you know, the money that went into it.
Did their university invest in it? Because one of the things that is also really striking about, you know, for example, universities like Stanford and MIT is, you know, when they have entrepreneurs on campus, they tend to back the entrepreneurs, yeah, keep the stake, and then that, you know, basically get cycled back into enormous resources for the university. Mm. And, you know, I've got a mate, in fact, I might invite on the show, who's doing enormous amounts of work in this sort with Oxford University. And, you know, they are backing some really exciting business. Well, and I think Oxford is now beginning to get returns from backing students with brilliant, you know, entrepreneurial ideas.
Funnily enough, so some of the businesses I'm working with in the Northeast, I'm meeting with Newcastle's University Chancellor actually this week, because to talk about this point about why don't we mobilise some of your students in the business and, you know, you guys get a stake in it? Because I think that is the way forward. You get that fresh talent of people with great ideas who've, you know, had the, who've got the space at university to be able to think big and think about, or wherever it is, further education colleges. It's not all about uni. I always go on about that. But to, you know, to space to develop these new ideas that could be commercially viable and make big money. And then, you know, there is a stake in it and there is returns to be had for the greater good of the country. And yes, of course, there's risk. I've invested in quite a few businesses now and some have gone bust already, but some are doing really, really well. And that's, you know, you can't focus on just the bad ones. You learn from the bad ones, but you can't focus on it. So I do think that the government should be taking more of a stake in things.
Yeah. I mean, but whether you, I suppose in the end, the question is it a misnomer calling this a national wealth fund, or is it just, you know, a sort of government kind of investment bank?
Yeah. Right. Should we have a break?
That would be great.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
You have goals. Reach them fast with IU Online's accelerated degree programs. Our 6 and 8 week courses are taught 100% online and can fit any schedule. Advance your career with a bachelor's in business administration. It only takes 10 minutes to apply. Earn an Indiana University degree that's valued around the world. Get started today at IU Online.
Welcome back to The Rest Is Money with me, Robert Peston.
And me, Steph McGovern. So we're going to talk about the TV and film industry now, because in the budget, the Chancellor gave quite a big shout out to the sector and announced some much needed help, because it's not a great time. We both know this. We both work in it. You know, ITV profits down 60% because of the advertising downturn. You know,
well, share price up.
Yeah, that's always one of those things you end up having to explain on the telly, isn't it? Why is the share price up, even though... But it's a lot to do with, you know, the forecasts for the future, isn't
it? Yeah, well,
they
said advertising has been absolutely terrible across commercial television. I mean, you know, ITV said that it looked as though it was going to be a bit better in the future than people had been fearing. And it also talked about job cuts. And one of the things that's, you know, was slightly depressing if we're in the industry is investors like it when companies say they're going to cut costs and sack people like you and me. So,
Yes. Yeah. And at the same time, you've got Channel 4 who have been cutting jobs and axing programs, mine included. The strikes in the American film industry have obviously put loads of projects on hold last year, and things haven't picked up particularly from that. So it is in a downturn at the minute. And BECTU, which is a union which represents the industry, is you know, the people in it, is saying it is in crisis. And there's some absolutely alarming stats from this, because obviously, anecdotally, I know from the people who worked on my show who lost their jobs at Christmas that there's still quite a few of them struggling to find work. And so Bechtel have done some research on this, looking at the overall industry, and they're saying 2/3 of people that they spoke to are out of work. Nearly a third of them have had no work at all for 3 months. And unsurprisingly, a lot of them are concerned about the financial security. And there's a good chunk of them, over a third, who are wanting to leave the industry now. They're planning to leave. It is a tough sector, but it's one that is actually also, if you look at some of the things that have been made here, like Barbie, the film that obviously was a box office smash last year, was made, a lot of it was made here. You know, we do have a reputation as being a great creative industry, but it's just tough times at the minute.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to sort of separate different parts of this industry. It's not one homogeneous whole.
Yeah.
What, you know, one of the things that the Chancellor did that looked really quite important was he said that for British independent films, there would be a 53% tax credit. As it happens, my oldest boy is in the process of trying to get funding for a film. And this had a stroke, increased the potential budget for his film by several million quid, right?
Wow.
So, you know, so this is a really powerful subsidy that the Chancellor has given. And it comes along on the back of the fact that, you know, we do have a really thriving, you know, filmmaking sector here. Studios that seem to be busy much of the time making, some of them, as you say, you mentioned Barbie, but I mean, Hollywood blockbusters. And even in your neck of the woods, the Chancellor gave some quite important help, didn't
he? I'm really excited about this, because one of the things I was most gutted about when my show ended was that pipeline of, you know, new people we were bringing into the TV industry who wouldn't have to move out of the north in order to work on national TV. But what I'm really excited about is, as you mentioned, is this plan to build one of Europe's biggest studios, which is now going to happen in Sunderland. So basically, they were banking on the Chancellor announcing this support. They've already built up something like £450 million worth of private investment, but they needed another £20 million or so every year for the next 10 years in order for this to actually happen. And now, because that was announced, there was an agreement made, and it's complicated, but it's through a devolution deal agreed between the government, the new North East Mayoral Combined Authority and Sunderland City Council, that this is now going to happen. But what it is going to be is this huge 20 studio, or I think they call them sound stages apparently, these 20 sound stages, which are going to be built on the banks of the River Weir. It's on an old industrial site. It was originally used for shipbuilding, then cranes, but it's been derelict for some time now. So they're going to build this huge site there with, you know, Hollywood blockbusters would be able to be made there, along with countless other shows. There's going to be obviously all the production offices. There's going to be a vendor village. You know, there's going to be all the retail that comes with it, a training academy. And it's likely, they say, to create 8,500 jobs and bring in £336 million a year for the local economy. But the biggest thing about it is the skills I think it will create and the people it will bring into the industry who otherwise couldn't work in it. Because, you know, the guy who's heading this up is from Sunderland. He's called Leo Perlman. He set up the company Fullwell 73, which you might know as it makes The Kardashians. I'm sure you watch that all the time. James Corden co-owns it. So they make The Late Late Show with James Corden. They made the Sunderland Till I Die series. The new version of that's just coming out soon. So he's kind of spearheaded this as a man who's done very well internationally with his team, but his heart is in Sunderland. And, you know, he's a big Sunderland fan. So yeah, he's worked on this project, which I think will make a huge difference. And one of the things he was saying is that the majority of the jobs in this industry, I think about 80% of them, are going to be not the me and yous, it's all the actors or whatever. It's carpenters, joiners, hair and makeup people, security, electricians, plasterers. It's those tradespeople, which actually we're brilliant at creating in the Northeast as well. So I think it's a really important thing for levelling up. And this is not just important for, you know, the film and TV sector. This is important for the region too, in terms of, you know, replacing that heavy industry that was once there. They're even calling it the Crownworks Studios off the back of the Crownworks was what it was known as, you know, for decades. So it's really important as a regeneration story and a leveling up story, having something as big as this being built in the Northeast, where typically, you know, very little money has been invested in TV and film.
Yeah, I mean, it actually slightly relates back to what we were saying before, though, because as far as I can see, this will just be a straightforward grant. And if it's going to be as successful as you say it is, there's got to be a question about why aren't we taking a stake in this?
Yeah, I agree. I think we should be taking a stake in it, because then that is prosperity for everyone off the back of it. Because I don't doubt that this is going to do well, given the, you know, the names and the companies who are behind it. So we should, if we're going to help, if, you know, if we as taxpayers are going to put money into this, I do think we should be getting a stake in it.
Yeah, no, that seems to be a missed opportunity. Yeah. I mean, the other aspect, obviously, that's on everybody's mind at the moment is the extent to which, with particularly drama productions, the extent to which AI, while cutting costs, is also, you know, you talked about all the jobs that are going to be created, but there's enormous anxiety around the place about, you know, whether it's, you know, putting actors out of work, writers out of work. I mean, this is across the piece.
Yeah.
There are anxieties.
Yes, there are, because do you remember a few weeks ago when we did that special on AI, I was talking about that company who could make like marketing or product demo films for you just from you inputting a bit of text. You don't need a studio to film it in. You don't need camera people. You don't need, you know, actors to perform it. It can all just be generated through AI. So there obviously is concern about it in terms of what the future is going to be. But I am always, I err on the side of optimism, which is that yes, AI will take some jobs, but hopefully there will be then other things to do, like create, you know, being the software developers or the, you know, all the coding and things like that. So, and you'll always need hair and makeup. There is no way AI is going to do hair and makeup. I'm sorry, but I would not like that. They're always going to be in demand.
A robot will be able to do hair and makeup. Let's be absolutely
no, they
clear.
Won't. Would you trust a robot to cut your hair? You wouldn't?
Maybe.
You wouldn't.
No,
I might. Looking at your hair, you might.
Oh, stop it! All right, I'm gonna tell my hairdresser what you just said, who is definitely the best hairdresser in London.
Yeah. The other things I just wanted to say, obviously, we've talked a lot about Sunderland, but you mentioned there were a few other things in there as well, and particularly that 53% rate you mentioned, and that this is for films with budgets under 15 million. And actually, Ben Roberts, who's chief executive of the British Film Institute, has said that this was the most significant policy intervention since the 1990s and a dramatic moment for UK film, which is what you want in a UK film. You want drama, so you want dramatic moments. So I would love to see what this means in terms of what we produce in the next few years.
I mean, I suppose one of the things that I want to say is we've been brilliant at being, in a sense, the subcontractor for Hollywood. I mean, so many Hollywood films get made here, although I think there is a bit of anxiety that the next Star Wars is not going to be made
for the first time, not made here,
But I think what's really positive is, you know, we have a long history of not only making films for the British market, and we have some films that, you know, they don't necessarily export well, but it is great to see support for, you know, an indigenous industry that might not just be producing our, you know, typical eccentric films that people love here, but could, you know, have a big market across the world. And actually, it was quite, it's moved the right word. I mean, I certainly thought it was important that Zone of Interest, a British film, really upsetting film. I don't know if you've seen it.
No, I haven't.
It's this really upsetting film about Auschwitz, and it's in German, and it won in the Oscars best overseas movie, right? And it's the first time actually a British film has ever won in that category. It's an amazing film, right? It's a great British success story. It's also, I would argue, a really important film in terms of people understanding how evil on a colossal scale happens. That sort of, you know, Hannah Arendt's point about the banality of evil is absolutely driven home by this film, which is all about how ordinary people can do absolutely appallingly despicable things.
The other thing about this is we're talking about film and TV, but it's also, this has a huge impact on the video game sector too. And we mentioned, didn't we, a few weeks ago, we talked about how important UK gaming sector is for the economy too, you know, again, worth billions of pounds. So all of this feeds in to each other, doesn't it? So I don't think you can talk about any in silo, can you? TV, film and games is all one big thing now, and all of this will help across the industry.
Yeah, I mean, look, we are brilliant in terms of our creative industries. It's an enormously powerful part of the British economy. And I think it is quite difficult to be, you know, doesn't matter what your politics are, it's quite difficult to be churlish about a government that is reinforcing that kind of success. Now, you know, I think to get back to our earlier discussion, we would just like to see a bit more imagination and a bit more ambition across the piece in terms of government support for a whole range of great British industries. But reinforcing success, and that's what's happening here, is a good thing.
Yeah. And on that note, we should probably end the show. Our next episode, we're going to answer questions, aren't we? I know we've had quite a few of them in. So our next Rest Is Money, we'll be answering those. If you want to send any in, it's restismoney@gmail.com, or you can contact us through our social medias, which is The Rest Is Money. Just search for that and you will find us. Right. We better go. Thank you very much.
We better. Thanks so much. See you soon.
Bye-bye.